The Guardian.
World Cup, World Cup. Every 4 years it's the World Cup, World Cup. If you don't pick up a grunge in the build-up, then we'll love it when you score a goal.
Ooh, did you see that?
World Cup, World Cup. It might all end in tears or a headbutt. You can follow all the blogging on your laptop. From Slovenia to Slovakia, from Nigeria to the Cote d'Ivoire.
Ooh, ah, Cote d'Ivoire.
The Guardian and Observer, packed with World Cup coverage every day.
World Cup Daily with James Richardson on Guardian.co.uk.
Day 10 of the World Cup, sponsored by Schadenfreude. And just as the world stops laughing at England and France, it's time to titter at Italy and France. Seriously though, the Italians 1-1 with New Zealand. Last time the Kiwis held an opponent this successfully, it was going bah. We get the reaction to the All Whites' latest exploits from our man in Wellington. Elsewhere on Sunday night, the Brazilians continued their smooth passage, but it's tusk-tusk to the Ivorians for Kaká's red card. The pod asks, what will it mean for the Seleção? Elsewhere, we take a wild guess at the contents of John Terry's big clear the air with Capello. There's post and an extra juicy preview of Monday's action. Portugal up against North Korea. Chile, Switzerland. Certainly can be. And Sidlow talking up Spain's chances against Honduras. As if. All of that in today's World Cup Daily. Hello, world. Another glorious mix of sublime and ridiculous at World Cup 2010 then. While England try and clear the air, New Zealand celebrate their smelts. And Brazil turn in that terrific performance with the odd rough bit against Ivory Coast late on Sunday night. Joining me for today's roundup, we have John Ashdown and Greg Ruffley and Amy Lawrence. Hello to you all.
Hello, James.
Hello. You seem perplexed to find yourself here. It is very much a dream team in that you're half asleep. But that aside, off we plod. Now, usually we have a kind of general intro, but it was so full of drama and incident, that Sunday night game, the Brazil-Ivory Coast match, that let's just wade straight in on that. Brazil, first of all, John, you were doing minute by minute. Good thing this is only a functional, kind of defensively-minded Brazil side, eh?
Yeah. No, they were very, very impressive. It was kind of a Rolls-Royce-type performance. They didn't even really need to put their foot on the gas too much, I didn't think.
Right.
They just sort of, they did enough. They were very solid at the back and then just turned it on two or three times going forward. And that was enough to see off the Ivorians. You're looking at me sceptically.
It's the Rolls-Royce metaphor that I'm intrigued by, but I don't know.
Why is that a strange metaphor?
Well, I think of them as quite stately, ponderous, things that kind of purr along, don't get used very much.
Well, Rolls-Royces?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they were quite stately and quite ponderous for large portions of the game. They didn't have a great deal of goal-mouth action in the
right.
First half.
Uh-huh.
And there was the one time when the back midfield two joined up with the front midfield three that they actually created that opportunity for Fabiano.
Right, but in your notes pre-World Cup, it clearly said that when you talk about Brazil, you have to use the metaphors about samba and Copacabana and beach like that, not motor
golf. It was more of a, what's a slow dance? Think of a slow dance with fast bits.
Right, okay. Good.
A rumba?
It might possibly a rumba.
Right, but anyway, Luis Fabiano, who hadn't scored for ages, had two cracking goals, although one of them, of course, he did handle a little bit. And it was quite sweet where the referee asked him if he'd handled it, and he said, no, I didn't. And then the referee kind of laughs and pats his chest, as if to say, well, I know you did, but I'm going to pretend that you didn't. And then Kaká as well, who's been receiving a lot of criticism, some of it from the pod, most hurtfully of all, of course. But another good assist from him.
Obviously, he's not going to remember tonight for the assist because he's going to be pretty miffed about sending off. Although when you look at it again, it's always that thing where he didn't exactly raise his arm, but I mean, he did sort of stick it out a bit.
Let's get on to the ugly stuff then, eh? And that was probably the ugliest bit of the encounter, although it was a pretty physical clash, this.
Yeah, and Caio da Cota shouldn't have even been on the pitch when he ran into Kaká and then went down holding his face as if he'd just been elbowed in the nose, because he'd actually just gone in and lunged in, almost broke someone's leg, and should have been sent off straight away for that.
So it was what was it, about 87th minute, 85th minute or something?
Kaká went.
And basically, yeah, Keita's running towards him, and you just see Kaká,
he's bracing himself. That's all he does.
It's not violent conduct in any way. He does slightly stick his elbow out a touch, and so it might have been slightly pointy when it did go into Keita's chest. But Keita goes around clutching his face, and he wasn't hurt in any way by it. No, it was bizarre, and it was occasionally bizarre performance and referee. That the handball incident was just ludicrous. It was more of a try than a goal. So much did he handle it. It's one of those things that it will get, you know, the sending off is not going to prove too important because he'll miss the last game and then he'll be back for the knockout stages.
Well, he might be out for more because having received a red card, it could have been called violent conduct, in which case he would potentially be facing a much longer ban.
This is Brazil and Kaká we're talking about, and I don't think FIFA are about to step in.
All right, do you think that FIFA might do anything to Keita? Is there any risk that he runs in terms of retrospective sanctions?
No, I don't think there is, because the referee's already seen the incident and he's decided that it deserved a booking and no more. I think had he not seen it, then it could have been reviewed.
Kaká missing the last group game, which is against Portugal, and possibly more, what does that mean, though? Because Ilano is presumably in doubt for that, at the very least, having been taken off in some pain.
He looked quite badly hurt. There was quite a few people pointing out on the email on the minute by minute that Keita had actually done Ivory Coast's chances no good at all by getting Kaká sent off, because Brazil will therefore, and injuring Ilano, because Brazil will now be weakened slightly for that Portugal game. It's a game that the Ivory Coast will want Brazil to win.
Right, Brazil currently topping the group on 6 points. Ivory Coast tied with Portugal, Brazil's next opponent, on 1 point. And Ivory Coast will be concluding their group games with North Korea.
Yeah. Can I just make a point about Ivory Coast that they'll be regretting that first game against Portugal, because it was obvious, you looked at it beforehand, and they needed a result against Portugal there and then, because the draw left them in this very sticky position that if they didn't beat Brazil, Portugal were likely to beat North Korea and then go into the final game knowing that Brazil might have the reserves out and it might be a much easier game for them. And at the end of that first game against Portugal, they had a corner and they had a few players up for it. And then they just took it short and held it in the corner and held on for the point. Now, I don't know if that's Sven Jørgen Eriksson masterstroke or not, but it just seems senseless to do that.
It does, doesn't it? Do you think Brazil are going to be significantly weakened without Ilano and Kaká?
They might not have played them anyway. They've qualified now, so they can put out who they want.
All right. The result against the Ivory Coast, does it confirm North Korea as a proper side, given that they managed to hold Brazil to a slightly tougher 2-1?
Well, it might have been 2-1 without the handball goal, so I suppose. I feel a bit sorry for Ivory Coast, because I think they're probably, well, they're one of the better of the African teams, but for the second World Cup in succession, they've really been drawn in a bum of a group. And I think if they'd have got one of the slightly easier groups around, they'd probably have gone through to the next round.
That's a refreshing title for it, isn't it? The group of bum, as opposed to the other one. Well, North Korea, anyway, tomorrow complete the second games in the group with their game against Portugal, echoes of Goodison Park in 1966, etc., etc., etc. But anyway, this time around, what can Yong Se Tai? That's not it at all, is it? What can Yong Te Sai? What can they do to the Portuguese defence? Give me your impressions of North Korea.
I think they hold onto the ball better than I expected, anyway, and they look well organised. So they can pass the ball around, keep possession, and I think that the fact that they can keep possession means that they're probably not going to get a good hiding, as many people might think they are, because they hold onto the ball for long periods of the game themselves. Portugal, though, they're going to have to step it up themselves, because that first game against Ivory Coast, they started well first 10, 15 minutes. Ronaldo hit a cracking shot against the post, but after that, they didn't really look like they were very enthusiastic, which is quite odd going into this tournament, you know.
Yeah, there's a schism with Cristiano Ronaldo, perhaps, is it? I don't know if they have a schism. I would have a schism if I was in a team with Ronaldo, but I'm not. So another booking will, of course, see him out of the final game against Brazil, and you couldn't rule out another booking.
That'd be a shame, wouldn't it?
Well, it would be for him, yes. But it is time for them, and indeed him, to step things up. Deco's going to be out, apparently, they say. Simão's going to be in, and I think Portuguese...
I don't think Deco was in the first game anyway. Yeah, he did a thing. His legs have gone.
Yeah, well, he said one or two things since to Queiroz. Or Queiroz, or however you pronounce that, and yes, won't be of the game on Monday. I don't know, I just thought the North Koreans, not only did they defend extremely well, maintaining concentration right throughout the game, but also when they did get the ball, they broke very, very simply and effectively, and I think they could, draw wouldn't be out of the question. But then, what do I know?
World Cup Daily with James Richardson, just like being in South Africa.
Elsewhere on Sunday, anyway, Italy, New Zealand. Oh my goodness. First off, well done to the Kiwis. And we're wondering what the reaction is there in New Zealand. Well, let's dial up our friend Colin Peacock of Radio New Zealand in Wellington. Colin, are you there?
I'm here. Good afternoon. Good evening, DJ.
Good morning to you, Colin, for such it is in New Zealand. Well, I've got a note of who's sheepish now, it says, and that's pointed at me for my my patronising remarks that I might have inadvertently made in the past. But what a performance. What was the reaction like there?
Well, you're not the only one to make those patronising remarks, so don't take that to heart too much. But, well, the reaction is, I mean, those who stayed up to watch it, the match was between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. here. So those who stayed up to watch it, I mean, probably just were so glad they did. Those who didn't are regretting it bitterly. There's been some vox pops done of people on the way to work that I heard on Radio New Zealand this morning, and people kicking themselves that they didn't stay up to watch it.
Did you stay up to watch it, Colin?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't get to sleep for about another 2 hours afterwards, so I think I've only been asleep for a couple of hours, and then got up so that, because I very much look forward to talking to you about the match, because, absolutely amazing, and I think someone on the minute-by-minute effort for The Guardian said that the last 20 minutes would be like the director's cut of Das Boot for New Zealand fans, and that's exactly what it was like. I've never really experienced a match like that in the dead of night, just hoping that the score wouldn't change, but they held on, and it was magnificent.
Well, more than that, you very nearly got the winner, didn't you?
Well, that's right. There were two shots, I think, they had in the second half. The veteran, Ivan Vissalic, had a long-range one, but it was that one from Chris Wood, the 18-year-old who plays for West Brom, with, I think, about 7 or 8 minutes to go. But, I mean, that would have just been stretching reality too much for them to have taken the lead at that point in the match. But to be honest, they just seem so comfortable. That's the thing that's impressing people here. We've seen backs to the wall stuff before, and of course there was a lot of that. They were getting battered, but sometimes they were still right at the end bringing the ball out of defence before, you know, getting rid of it and playing for position, almost like in rugby. But at times they just seem to be dealing with it so well that you just marvelled at it, because it's just something we haven't seen before from the All Whites, I don't think.
Yeah, two draws so far, two goals from three shots on goal, which is pretty impressive. And I have to say, either Italy are worse than Slovakia, or you are getting better.
Yeah, or even a certain other team in plays in white who've had a couple of draws so far, you know, been looking at their performances and sometimes seeing the same sorts of way of playing and inability to hold the ball and all of that. But they managed to hold out Italy, and you know, the comeback against Slovakia, I mean, that was very last minute, so not a lot of people held out a lot of hope that they wouldn't be comfortably beaten today by Italy. But I mean, it really does put Italy under pressure too. But no, the team was the fans here were hoping that they would go into the last match with Paraguay not out of the competition, as you know, the likes of Cameroon are already, that there would be something to play for. But I mean, this time, if they can actually go one step better and get a win, well, they'll go through to the second round. But I mean, after the match, Ricky Herbert, the coach, has said, well, bring on Paraguay, you know, they're going to find us bloody hard to beat, which is indeed true. But I mean, if they really want to progress, they've got to take that other step. But I think one moment I think that summed up the match for me was when they brought on, with about 30 seconds to go, Andy Barron as a substitute. And he's the guy who only ever gets referred to because he's the amateur. He's the player who still works in a bank here in Wellington. So I wonder if Ricky Herbert put him on, not for tactical reasons, but just to show the world that that all this stuff about them being a team of postmen and bank clerks and so on is sort of true to a point. And to throw the guy on for the end to get a cap, I thought was a nice touch.
Colin, excellent. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. And, well, I can only imagine that we're going to be speaking to you after your triumph over Paraguay in the final group game.
Well, we'll see, but I mean, they did look extremely slick, didn't they, Paraguay? So, I mean, they could well end up topping the group if they get the result against New Zealand. And, well, that the Italy-Slovakia one is going to be something to watch, isn't it?
Absolutely. No need of turning over to Deer Hunter in the final day of Group F action. Excellent, Colin. Thanks very much for joining us. We speak to you soon.
That's all right. They actually had Platoon on before this match, bizarrely.
Ah, dear. In the World Cup, truth is the first casualty, I think, or something like that. Good. Ricky Herbert earns about $55,000 New Zealand dollars. That's about £26,000. Any for fans of perspective? There you go. I should say, in Italy's defence, shocked looks from everybody. I should, producer Ben, say in Italy's defence that A, they hit the post, and B, the goal that New Zealand scored was offside. But honestly, what a shower.
In Italy's defence, there was a very old man called Cannavaro who's looked a bit shaky on two occasions when the ball's come over.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first goal was exactly the same as
the one conceded
against Paraguay and, found wanting again.
Yeah. Do you know, Italy have conceded two goals from only two shots on target conceded in their first two games of this World Cup. And as you say, they're identical, the free kicks. But
what I thought was particularly worrying is you're looking at Italy, who are the world champions, bringing on three offensive players to try and change the game against a team who's 78th ranking in the world.
Yeah.
New Zealand coming to this tournament with only South Africa and North Korea ranked below them.
I think there were all sorts of...
Considering, Lippi tried so much, everybody knows that this squad is quite different in terms of experience and what have you than the team from 4 years ago. But he clearly doesn't have a clue, I don't think, what is his best attacking option. It seems to me sort of...
Everybody else does, and it doesn't involve the word Gilardino, but Lippi's got this great alliance to the boys of 2006, and he keeps...
If he had such a great alliance, then where was Totti, or where was...
Well, I think Totti, there were other issues, because he's physically not fit enough, and he's already retired once from the national side. Alan Fogg Zomberi says, Jimbo, can you justify the Italians' performance today, not in terms of quality, but moral cowardice? The full repertoire of cheating was in evidence, diving horrible fouls behind the refs back, etc., etc., etc. The World Cup would be much, much better off without him. Have to say, Alan Fogg Zomberi, I'm a bit partial on this, but I didn't see it that way. I thought New Zealand elbows were flying, and yeah, there was a little bit of gamesmanship from the Italians, but no more than I've seen from pretty much every other team. The reaction in Italy, but I wonder what the yay, nay on that, what do you think? Were they particularly dirty today, the Italians?
I think New Zealand gave as good as anything else.
The reaction in Italy, anyway, was pretty much, we need Cassano. Bit late now. They're a mediocre team. Wake up, everybody, was La Repubblica's view. And Gianni Mura there, always with an excellent view, just wonders how Lippi hasn't managed to explain to his players, or why it didn't dawn on him, that against the pretty big defensive lineup of the all-whites, it wasn't a good idea to continually pump in these crosses, because Italy had possession right through the match. I don't know what the final stats were, but it must have been about 80-20 or something like that. But in terms of shots on goal, nothing. It was just these balls floated in that Gilardino would miss or not control, and off we go. Anyway, there you go. Next up, they play Slovakia, who just got beaten by Paraguay, Greg, who...
I was very impressed with today. Yeah, They've brought this formation to the tournament with three strikers who actually play up front all together. It's not like a 4-5-1 with two supporting attacking midfielders. They had Barrios, Cruz and Valdez today up front, and Vera in midfield, who was actually getting forward as well. So a lot of people criticised Slovakia for playing deep and playing defensive against them today and saying, well, why didn't they come out? Because they're the team who needed the win more. And I'd say the reason they were playing defensive football is because Paraguay would just play so high up that they didn't give them an opportunity.
It was bizarre, though, because Paraguay in the first game against Italy spent the entire 90 minutes in their own half, and this time they spent the entire 90 minutes in the opposition half. Very flexible team, chameleon-like.
Yeah, and I don't know, against Italy they scored an early goal as well, so maybe we didn't see this side of them, because after they scored the first goal today, in the second half they did lapse for maybe 15-20 minutes before they scored the second goal, and maybe looked a little bit more defensive, and maybe that's a psychological thing. But I was very impressed, and I just think it's refreshing to see an attacking formation. And also they've got Cruz, who's a very tall striker, so at any time that they might think that the small short passes, the quick passes aren't working, they can actually go direct and play a ball to him. And when he flicks it on, they've got two strikers running onto it, not just one. And it makes it very difficult for the defenders to pick them up.
Cracking. And they've got potentially a decent route through to the quarterfinals, haven't they? Because if they do top the group, they are at the moment, they've got 4 points, Italy and New Zealand on 2 points, Slovakia on one. They would face Japan or Denmark as things stand at the moment.
Yeah, and I think they'd fancy that. I think from what people have seen in Japan, from what I've seen of Denmark as well, I mean, Denmark will give you the goal anyway, so Paraguay won't even have to score one, I don't think. And then they'd be through to the quarterfinals, and they could prove quite resolute opposition for somebody.
Yeah. They've also got a lot of strength in depth, because they've got Oscar Cardozo on the bench, who plays for Benfica and scored an awful lot of goals for them. So they've got three world-class strikers, and Roque Santa Cruz.
Yeah. Paraguay, eh? Pod's tip for, something. While all this was going on Sunday, there was action elsewhere, Amy. Les Bleus were turning the air bleu at their training ground, as is their wont. with, in fact, won't was the operative word. We won't train. I won't, you know, stand any more of this any longer. Okay, here was the news anyway. Basically, Nicolas Anelka, you recall, told, pardon my French, the manager to go and fuck himself, you dirty son of a whore, boss. And then he got told he might want to go home. And then Captain Patrice Evra clashed in training with the team's fitness coach. This was all on film, wasn't it?
Yeah, fantastic viewing, actually. I don't know what was the better video, the video of this great clash between Evra and the fitness coach, who then walked off in a huff and very melodramatically chucked his accreditation down on the turf and in a very Gallic, flary way. It was quite fantastic. And then later on, there was a great clip of Raymond Domenech looking really pathetic, standing with a little piece of paper on the edge of a hill with the wind flapping around, reading out this statement from the players where they'd gone into the bus and closed the curtains of the windows of the bus and had this conflab where they decided, although presumably they must have decided this beforehand, that they weren't actually going to train if it was about Nicolas Anelka rather than about the Evra incident.
Well, they were training when they had the altercation, weren't they? And then they all trooped off the field, I think. And then the statement said, stick it up les bollocks or something. I'm not sure.
But I mean, basically, I think the old French World Cup winner, Brigitte Lizarazu, was quoted as saying, it's like being in an episode of The X-Files. This is science fiction. I mean, people in France are absolutely beyond bewildered. There's people I know who are football fans who have said they're so disgusted by the whole thing, they don't want to follow football anymore.
Really?
And there's quite a lot of, you know, highly emotional reaction. People are devastated, although they really shouldn't be that surprised. Something was always coming regarding this French team, although you wouldn't have quite expected it to be as mad as this.
Do you think player power will prevail now and they'll get what they want in terms of the tactics that they play and maybe the team lineup? Because at the end of the statement, I think they said, we've forgotten none of our duties, we'll do everything individually and also in a collective spirit to ensure France, you know.
I don't know about you, I'm getting a bit fed up with these statements from players. You know, we've got a lot of very pampered, highly paid people who have, you know, feel a sense of obligation towards their duties when they feel like it and feel like apologising when they feel like it. And it all seems to be down to them and their whims. And I just think that, you know, it's not necessarily a coincidence that the three nations that are in the biggest and most hilarious crises, which is England, France and Italy. These are the countries where you've got incredibly highly paid players who are very costed and live in a world that means they think they can do whatever they like. I don't know how much it's the manager's fault. For some of the people who have been having a go at Capello, for instance, I think it's quite funny from the England players' point of view that, you know, they complained on Sven-Göran Eriksson that he was a bit too lax and, you know, not emotional enough and not dominant enough. They complain under Capello that apparently it's too strict. Well, come on, what on earth do you want?
Well, I don't know, because they've been telling Capello what they want this evening. I mean, Sunday evening, they had these big fantastic quotes from John Terry, who first off let us all know that he thought Nicolas Anelka was right to tell his... And that was a fairly interesting way to begin his comments, saying that, yeah, I thought what Nicola can is a top bloke and he knows a lot about football. So when he says something, you listen. That's what John O'Dea said. What Nicolas Anelka had said.
Not
was
many
that you
people
can take
know,
up the
know what Nicolas Anelka thinks because he doesn't want to
well,
say
that's
it very
another
often.
Point, yeah. In fact, if he says anything, you'd probably stop what you were doing and call your friends over to have a look. Look, it speaks. Anyway. We've got a meeting tonight to see where we went wrong, Terry told a press conference. That's probably the whole 93 minutes. Everyone needs to get off their chest exactly how they're feeling. If it upsets him, Fabio Capello in brackets, or if it upsets any player, then so be it. What are they possibly going to be discussing? Having ketchup back on the table at the dining room? Or
maybe
what?
They want a night out with the wags.
I mean, no,
could
possibly.
Be sexual tension in the camp, or, you know.
It would be surprising if it wasn't.
Perhaps they're sick of listening to Capello, because when he talks, they have to listen. If they go out with the wags, then they can just switch off for a night, can't they, you know?
Very possibly, Craig. Is this going to be, then, the watershed moment of England's World Cup campaign, do you think, John?
No, because the fact of the matter is the players aren't quite good enough, never mind the systems that they play or the players that get picked. They might pick up and improve, and they could certainly still beat Slovenia in that last game. Because occasionally during Capello's run, it has all clicked together. And whether that means the players get their way and Joe Cole comes in for Emil Heskey and they tweak the formation.
What, and play Wayne Rooney up front?
Well, yeah.
It's a fantastic theory, post from Mike Birtwistle. who says he doesn't follow football much, but here's some quotes anyway that he researched in 20 minutes from when England got knocked out of the 2006 World Cup to Portugal. Paul Wilson writing, Sven-Göran Eriksson and his half-baked plan to play Wayne Rooney as a lone striker was responsible for making him peripheral. And it goes on, there's various three or four writers, they're all from The Guardian, unfortunately, saying, this man, Sven-Göran Eriksson, what a chancer. Anyway, so... Yes,
it's sort of it's weird, isn't it? It does feel it's beginning to feel like the end of an era in a sense, and that sort of end, you know, the fact that not so much perhaps with the manager, but with the certain players that have just seemed to have been in the team for so long now and have underachieved for so long. Well, I say underachieved, but haven't achieved anything for so long now that you can almost. It would be nice. I think after the tournament, it'd be nice if it's a new manager or if it's Capello said. You know, we need a bit of a new broom sort of thing, sweep out a bit of the deadwood's a bit harsh for people like Gerrard and Lampard, but actually bring in a few different players and just change it around because it just feels a bit staid.
These players don't need instructions as well. I don't think they need packing with instructions in the way other people think they might do. I mean, they're 28, 29, 30 years old. They've been playing all their careers and adapting to different formations now over like 10 or 12 years in professional football. If they see things aren't happening on the pitch and aren't going right, then you change. I mean, I played football when I was 17. I remember my manager saying, well, what went wrong in the first half there? And I said, well, you've got five men in midfield. We've got three. He went, well, then you call one of your forwards back, don't you? And he wasn't saying he should be the man who tells me to do it. He was telling me I was supposed to do that myself on the pitch. That was when I was 17. So these players should be able to work this out on the pitch themselves.
Wasn't Barney Rona going on excitedly about the fact that Capello's bag, his World Cup travel bag, contained a copy of Barney Rona's book, The Football Manager? Surely that's where everything's gone wrong.
You think so?
Yeah, it may well be. Barney, what have you done?
Oh, Barney.
Oh, dear. Post, NS Red says, look, South American teams now top all the five groups in which they play. The question is why? Why, John Ashton, why?
Well, I put this question to readers of my Minute by Minute this evening for the Brazil game, and they came up with five answers.
Did they?
Shall I go through them for you?
Yeah, go on then.
Why not?
Yeah.
Well, the first one that was suggested is that the domestic season in South America is split up into the Apertura and the Clausura, the two separate seasons, so they have more time to rest.
Ooh.
That sort of is slightly
Because people
dubious.
Say the same thing about Germany, because they have the winter break and they're doing really well.
Plus, a lot of South American players are based in Europe, of course.
Yeah, that's true.
Second thing is the climate, you know, being down in the summer southern hemisphere.
Well, there's nothing like Brazil.
But, you know, I don't know, short evenings, the blood in the head is spinning the right way around and that sort of thing.
That's my point.
Yeah.
The plug hole.
Stolen that one.
Oh, I reckon it's a hemisphere thing, that everybody, all the Europeans, they're just dizzy because things are turning the wrong way round. You think about it, they're effectively upside down and the world is revolving in the wrong direction. On a very subtle level, that's affecting their synapses. You know, in 100 years' time, medical science will have caught up with me and they'll know about these sort of things. But all it means is that you have to say, well done all the South Americans who come and play up in on the top half of the world.
Absolutely.
Sorry, do you want to go on with your list?
Think how good they'd be if they're in the southern hemisphere.
Yeah,
still.
Well, they are being, you see. Anyway, sorry, you go on with
the list. The third one was the attacking mindset. Bielsa at Chile has certainly been a proponent of that one.
Yep.
One thing that was mentioned was the fact that they play at altitude a fair bit during qualifying.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an interesting one, in Ecuador and Bolivia and places. Mm. Although they only do it sort of once or twice a year, so I don't know how much that would really affect them. And the final reason or suggestion was that European teams have a very worldwide exposure now, or European leagues are watched all around the world. And so everybody knows about the European style of football, whereas Europe itself is far more insular and doesn't really pay a great deal of attention to
South
American football.
So they've got the advantage of surprise.
Perhaps, yeah.
All right. So by that token, the Chileans will know all about the Swiss, but the Swiss will be... Completely in the dark.
Yeah. I'm not saying that these are all definite reasons or anything. These are just ideas could be.
I tell you what, they can all come together with my hemispheral argument to produce a kind of heady cocktail of South American dominance. Will that continue when Chile take on Switzerland, do you think?
Hopefully, because, well, as I was saying earlier, Brazil are a bit like a Rolls-Royce performance earlier on this evening, which I'm going to keep saying despite the look of doubt on your face. Chile was sort of a bit like
Samba.
A souped-up Ford Fiesta, you know, really exciting. And,
a Capri.
You know, yeah, sort of.
Like in The Professionals, one of those cars.
Absolutely, yeah, just sort of not quite as
proper old-fashioned raw.
Yeah, but a little bit knocked together maybe, but really exciting and good to watch. And nobody really wants to see that much more of
Switzerland.
All right. Well, anyway, Switzerland stuns Spain. They also haven't conceded a goal now. Is it five World Cup matches? Is pretty phenomenal stuff. So it is going to be interesting how, you know, this swarming, buzzing Chilean attack with that great Alexis Sanchez and the top scorer from South American qualifying, Humberto Suazo, coming back in.
He's going to be back here.
Yeah, how that's going to do. It's going to be a cracking match, though. I'm looking forward to it myself. Amy, quick prediction on the game. What do you think? No, don't have an idea.
No, I was just thinking I'm quite interested to see how Switzerland can, you know, if they can repeat the trick, really.
Yeah, all right. Honduras, meanwhile, in the other game in that group, are taking on the Spanish. It wouldn't be a Spanish preview without Dr. Sid Lowe in Spain. And indeed, here he is.
Hello, James Hayden.
I'm doing very well. Now, I should just say, it's about, 10 past midnight in Madrid. And that sounds like the merry clink-clink of cutlery. Is you're having what? Your lunch? Your afternoon tea? What?
No, I'm actually eating a bowl of ice cream.
Mmm. Very nice. What flavour?
What flavour is it? Strawberry.
Oh. And what are you wearing, Sid, while you eat this ice cream?
I'm wearing a pair of shorts and a T-shirt.
Crikey. Yeah. Sid, there was all that business, of course, with Spain going and losing their game against Switzerland. And has everything calmed down a bit now? Is the view that that was a healthy wake-up call, or are there worries that it's the sign of something potentially more damaging?
Well, it depends who you listen to. And one of the things that was most striking about it was that one of the people who came out immediately after the game and was quite critical of Spain was Luis Aragonés, of course, the former Spain coach. And more importantly than what he said was wrong, which was from his point of view, he said a kind of a lack of commitment, a lack of aggression, a lack of if you like, kind of competitiveness about the way that Spain played. That mattered. What mattered more, I think, was what he said in terms of how long that's been going on. And I think most people were able to look at that game or did look at that game and say, Spain got certain things wrong, but they generally haven't been getting things wrong, so we should give them the benefit of the doubt. Luis Aragonés is one of the few people who, after the game, not only did he say that, he then said, and this has been coming for a long time. And I think that did spark a few people saying, well, have we not seen things? Are we missing something? Is there something slightly deeper? But bit by bit, what's happened is that the attitude has become more and more positive as time has gone on since that game. I think there was the initial shock and a few knees jerking. I think since then, most people have said, well, hang on, we need to be a bit calmer about this. We need to not panic, not least because they're seeing every other team from their point of view, apart from possibly Brazil and Argentina. They're seeing every other team at the World Cup not particularly impressed either. So I think the feeling now is that there are certain little things that need ironing out, but they don't need to panic. There was a momentary question mark over the way Spain play, but I think everybody now thinks that the Spanish style, the basic approach, is still the right one.
There was a couple of comments as well about the body language, the body language as they left the field, that there was it seemed to be the players playing the blame game, trying to pass off responsibility for the defeat on one another. Has there been any follow-up on that?
There wasn't really much comment about that here. I know that's something that's been picked up a little bit elsewhere, but in Spain, nobody has really, not with any seriousness or with any real conviction, talked about divisions within a squad. Of course, there's been question marks about, well, who is to blame and were players feeling a little bit unfortunate with each other. But I think most people looked at this and looked at it as a kind of a game that went wrong rather than a system that's going wrong and rather than a group of players that are going wrong. In fact, one of the things they've insisted on time and time again is that behind the success of the European Championships wasn't just Spain's football, it was also the togetherness of the squad in terms of the fact that this is a good group. And of course, and I actually think this is a bit unfair, although I would broadly speaking say it's right, of course a lot of that is pointing the finger at Raúl and saying this Spain squad got to be a much better group of human beings and of people and in terms of living together after Raúl left it than it was when he was there.
The other question, of course, is if Mrs. Casillas is going to be larking about behind the goal during the next match, Sid. Crucially.
Yeah, extraordinary. When I saw that story, which began in the Times, the story claimed that people in Spain were blaming Sara Carbonaro and Iker Casillas' girlfriend for the failure of Spain to win the game, for the fact that they were beaten in the first game, and that Iker Casillas' eye had been taken off the ball to some extent. And it's just not true. Nobody in Spain was blaming Sara Carbonaro whatsoever, apart from maybe one or two morons on internet forums, I suspect, maybe. But nobody was doing that in Spain. And that meant that the backlash, this story became big, because it actually, if you like, became the other side. So whereas in England, or in one particular newspaper, they were saying the Spanish are blaming Carbonaro, in Spain they were saying, I don't believe it. The British media are blaming Carbonaro. What are they talking about? I'll be honest with you, I suspect it was an excuse to get a picture of her on the front cover.
Sure. But it's all a bit Spinal Tap, isn't it? Bloody girlfriend coming along on the road, ruining the relationship. I can see it all happening.
Well, one of the things that was interesting is, of course, if you like, the kind of Exhibit A, the piece of evidence that proved that there was something funny going on, was the post-match interview between Sara Carbonaro and Iker Casillas. Now, this is something that has for a long time had everybody talking about it. When we first found out that Telecinco, the channel, were going to go to the World Cup and she was going to be there, everybody was saying, oh, I wonder what the post-match interviews are going to be like. I wonder, will they give each other a kiss? And, ooh, you know, there was a little bit of kind of titillation about it. And then, and I'll be honest with you, I was in the studios of a TV company in Barcelona when that interview happened. And someone shouted out, hang on, Iker's being interviewed by Sara Carbonaro. And everyone kind of raced to the TV to see what's happening. And afterwards, everyone went, oh, that was a bit boring. She was very, very professional. And so was he. And it wasn't a big deal. So that particular piece of evidence, I thought, was evidence of the fact that they're both getting on with their lives perfectly normally and their professional lives perfectly normally, even though they crossed on in that moment.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Quick prediction, Sid?
I just don't think that first game is a problem for Spain. I think Spain will not only get through the group, I think they'll win the group. I think they'll win the next two games.
All right then, Sid. Magnificent. Thank you very much for joining us on this lovely Madrid evening. And we'll speak to you soon. OK, that wraps it up then for today's World Cup Daily. Thanks to producer Ben, John Ashdown, Greg Ruffley, and Amy Lawrence. Thanks for joining us. We're back at a similar time tomorrow, so hopefully you'll be part of that whole experience. For now, though, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.